Welcome to 5 Lives to 50, the sustainability podcast for product managers. I am Shelley Metcalf, and I'm with my two co-hosts, Jim Fava and Neil D'Souza. And in today's episode, we are excited to have a special guest join us to share his experience and perspective on how to embed sustainability into products. Dan Fitzgerald works for Stanley Black & Decker, where he is the Product Sustainability Senior Director. And if you don't know about Stanley Black & Decker, it is the largest tool company in the world with over 100 manufacturing facilities worldwide. And as the Product Sustainability Senior Director, Dan leads the Innovate with Purpose pillar under the Corporate Social Responsibility Strategy, which includes goals focusing on addressing unmet societal needs, circular design, and sustainable supply chain. Welcome, Dan. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me. Very happy to be here.
I also want to, you know, welcome you. And you and I have known each other for quite a few years and have worked together. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation and sharing and learning a lot from what Stanley Black & Decker is doing.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation, Dan.
Yeah, me too. Well, how would I kick us off? Dan, I was wondering from your experience and perspective, if you could start by telling us what you think or see as hindering product managers from embedding sustainability into products.
From my view, it's not that product managers don't want to. I just think the nature of the job has been so granularly focused on the details of the product itself, you know, in operation, like how much does it weigh for a tool? You know, how much power does it have? Does it rest nicely on my bell hook, right? I mean, we're talking very sort of personal preferences on how you use a product. And during those interactions and gathering those requirements of what is going to make a winning product be, doesn't typically involve asking about sustainability. And it's not that end users don't care about it. I think it's just there's an assumption from an end user that things of that nature, such as, you know, are you following the laws or you're doing the best to minimize impact when you create things, right? I think they assume that companies are doing that already. And it's not really on them to tell them, even if they, you know how to communicate that in the first place. Because sometimes if you're not in that space, you just don't know the details. And so what I think is misses a little bit is that the follow-up is, hey, they're not saying anything about it. They don't care about it. And so it doesn't get placed in a high priority in the product specification because the end user isn't directly saying it. But we all know it is needed at some point to either pass through a regulatory requirement or even the customer. And in our case, our customers are retailers, right? Because we don't sell direct to the end user. So a customer may have a requirement because they're focused on sustainability that we need to meet such that the end user has an option to buy it in that store.
Dan, could you clarify that a bit? Because I think that's unique to the other conversations we've had. You have two customers, and I think that's not obvious to everyone.
We maybe even have more behind the contractor, right? The person that hires the contractor could also have requirements. So I think this idea of the expanding end user and seeing it a more of a worldview about everything you have to hit to get a product out the door, that's when sustainability starts making it in to the document.
There was a study done by McKinsey, I think back in 2019, if I'm not mistaken, where they asked exactly this question because they were wondering, why is it that we don't see sustainability in requirements from customer surveys? And what they found was customers expected brands to take care of this. I think it was a pretty significant number that said, we're assuming the brands we buy from are not engaging in unsustainable practices. Just think of it the other way around. There's regulation in Europe that principally says you need to state, you need to do due diligence on your supply chain and make sure you report on what the status is. So if you were to flip that and say, would a customer buy your product if you claim we have child labor in our supply chain? Obviously not. I think in the past, if there was something bad happening in the supply chain, you didn't need to tell anyone about it. Mm-hmm. But this has become very, very different, especially I think regulations in Europe are forcing this. In one of these podcasts, I mentioned what Europe is doing is it, and what regulation does in general is it makes you live in a glass house. And people live very differently when they're in a glass house. And let's imagine a company living in a glass house. That's what the regulations are doing in Europe around transparency. And then it's super important to ensure that the company takes care of this and not just relies on the fact that, hey, customers are not explicitly asking us for sustainability. And I think just to elaborate on the two kinds of customers, you guys sell to retailers and then retailers sell to customers. And the needs and requirements that each of them have can be different. For direct-to-customer businesses, I think this is slightly different. But I think for you guys, this is a significant detail when thinking about sustainability strategies.
It is for sure. But what I do think it helps with is that while the end user may not be saying it early days or mentioning anything about it, the customer kind of gives the cue to us, need to be focusing on this, right? And our regulatory department as well. But the big thing I found is if it's legally required or there's an official framework, you know, truth in advertising, safety code, right? All of that stuff in our product development, we handle it not through the end user saying, hey, I don't want that thing to shock me, right? They don't say that. Just like all the right? But we have bolt-on functions along the way in the product development process that check in and say, hey, are you doing that? Or, oh, you want to say this? No, you have data for that, right? So things that have made it from maybe starting at sustainability that have become law, it's falling into those areas and we're addressing, right? The really sweet spot of how do you crack this nut of like, how far do you go more voluntarily on the sustainability? How much recycled, if the threshold's 10% from New Jersey in packaging and you want to go 50% to get ahead of the game or, you know, where does that come into the design process to do that? If not the end user or a customer or government. And so I think that's really the place to focus on, right? If you want to go over and above and by how much, kind of almost need to build that into that product spec spot. Because to me, that's the spot where you're not prescribed by some law somewhere to do something like truth in advertising, right? It's what does the customer want, right? You can do whatever you want there, you know, hoping that it matches what they need. And that same opportunity is there for the voluntary sustainability stuff at that point in time, which is why I think it's so critical that it needs to be in that document, because no other function along the way is going to be checking in because it's not formal law requirement yet.
I'm curious about that very example that you mentioned. Let's say there's a law that says you need to hit a 10% recycling quota. Somehow this needs to be plugged into the development process. Whether it's now 15 or 50 or 100%, it would have already been in the development process. The same thing with you should not shock people, right? How did that come? There's no obvious requirement that says, please don't shock people, right? So I'm very curious about how these kind of non-explicit requirements make their way into the design requirements.
I think a core of all business ethics is to follow laws. So first and foremost, you're going to say, you know, we follow laws. If the law's there, we're not going to not abide by it. But I think over and above, within the backdrop of the safety topic, you also have the civil court system, which, you know, you cannot follow the law, go through your criminal penalties. But then on top of that, if an injury has occurred due to that, right, you also have a potential financial risk associated with that. You know, I don't know. I don't know how it evolved, but obviously if you're a startup company and you're putting out unsafe stuff and you're being sued and losing a lot of money, you're not going to be in business very long. So it is a negative cost avoidance on top of following the law there as well, right? Yeah. That I think helps drive it.
Yeah, Dan, just to follow up on that, I think one of the things I saw you posting recently on LinkedIn, which I'm not sure I got the exact wording, but you know, your feeling is that the companies are going to have to embed sustainability innovation because the customers are, you know, the end users are demanding it, or, you know, regulations will require it. And so you assume, okay, the customers or consumer demand it and regulations will require it. And I thought that was right on. It was a good exchange, I think, with the author of that little article that you responded to. You also had a question there or point. The issue that really has to be dealt with is what has to happen to actually enable the customer and the end user to reach a level that the product managers are all responding or the regulations have reached a level that it's a no-brainer. It's a must in every innovation. And so there's a timing, a speeding scale kind of thing that I wondered if you could speak a little bit to how to accelerate that with your vision of what you articulated.
Yeah, so that question was really around, you know, what needs to happen, and how I kind of envision it is you've got like a starting point, you know, the very front end of I'm going all sustainable 100% that I'm a super leader, right? I'm going to do it because it's the right thing, all the way to I'm not doing it until a regulation tells me I have to. And companies are all over that spectrum between being the front end best and just barely keeping up with regulation, and some even fall behind it and get in trouble. The point is, you know, they say, they were asking, like, how do you move that? You know, to me, it's moving, the front's moving, the back's moving, you know, at different rates, but you're trying to stay within it or in front of it, wherever you want to be. You know, what drives that is either from a traditional marketing market supply demand perspective is either you've got people out there really demanding it, paying for it. You see the sales happening. So you say, this is what our customer wants. We got to go get it. I don't care what regulation says. So it's on those customers to enact change by buying better. And then on the regulatory side, again, it's to the people, because it's who you vote for and what policies you'd like them to interact or enact, because the government essentially can direct where the innovation of capitalism goes to make sure it continues pointing in the right direction, and that, you know, making money on its own doesn't necessarily imply good. So you need to be able to vote for people that can say, you know, capitalism is good in the sense that it opens up this innovation machine, but it needs to be pointed to the right things we want as a society, or else we'll get things out of that machine that we don't love. So that's, you know, my thought on that is that it's really the power is in the people's hands by either how you buy or vote. And those things drive what the companies do, either on the front end or the back end.
So, Dan, I'm wondering, when you're talking about either the end users who are already expecting the company to embed sustainability, or there's this zone where it's beyond the regulation, but a company can decide how much they want to volunteer into taking on sustainable practices. What have you seen that's worked well in this space? And how have you seen that work well for product managers to address that?
I feel like one of the areas I've noticed where product managers are more willing to focus on sustainability and try to bed that in more is around when we're looking to expand market share. So when you're in a situation like that, you're willing to give up a little bit of margin, right, to do something that maybe differentiates yourself from somebody else. Like, if we go by the theory that things that are sustainable or, you know, have benefits like that, materials and stuff generally cost a bit more than the basic commodities available on the market, then you're going to embed that, right? You'll get a claim out of it, but you also have a cost associated with it. And the question is, can you either recover that cost if you need to maintain margin, or will you reduce your margin, eat the cost, and sell it at the same price and try to gain market share as a differentiator? So I think there is more of a play for it there. If you're kind of leading the category and you've got a nice margin, right? And also your end user's assuming it's there and they're not indicating to you that if you do something better that they're going to pay more for it, right? Because that's kind of what the end user research is saying. Then it's a very tough sell. You're saying, you want me to put cost into it for a functional benefit that my end user won't pay for. It's a very difficult thing to do. I find that, you know, market expansion is an area, right? If you're looking to gain some share, that's a potential. And another thing just to mention on this topic is I feel it's really critically important to have areas of the company that kind of focus on de-risking. And what I mean by that is, again, in product development organizations, you're given the task. Usually it's not anything brand new from the scratch up. I mean, most of our stuff is the next generation drill, the next generation saw, right? It's iterative improvement. So the spec sheet that comes in from product marketing kind of lays out, like, here are the four or five bullet points that the customer says is like, what's bad with our current drill, what's good about a competitor's, here's what we need to do in the next generation to regain share or keep up or take more share. And so those engineers take that in, and that's what they focus on. And if I come to them and say, hey, why don't you consider a new material, right? Their mind is like, well, my job is on this paper and it doesn't say that. And also, by the way, bringing in a new material brings a lot of risk, because I at least know with the last one, with the same general design and weight, it passed drop test, cold drop, all the things you need to prove out. So it's very risky in a tight timeline project to do that. So my suggestion is, as you're looking at these new materials and evaluating, right, all the way from startups to reputable companies with new material offerings, is you need a team to kind of trust but verify that what they're saying can be done, can be molded, you know, the basic hurdles of using a material, such that you've de-risked it enough to allow a product team to try to change over. And that's really our line Reviva in Black & Decker, which is our first power tool line that was leading with the sustainable message. You know, that's kind of what happened. The idea came up in the product development room where, you know, people are like, okay, what do we do next? What projects are we going to resource for the year? And so somebody had said, oh, look, the data saying sustainability is getting more important, right, to the DIY end user. And that's becoming more important in the household. So they came out of that meeting and they came over to the materials team and were like, what do you got? What can we do? And we had, thankfully, I mean, not planned, just out of the blue, had already been working with Eastman Chemical for about a year, kind of doing the color match and de-risking things. And we were hunting around the organization for a project, right? And then one kind of came to our lap. So it was one of those cliches of like preparation met opportunity, right? Lucky. But I think it's very important, though, to have team. I mean, you got to have a team searching at that new stuff, pressure testing it, making sure that it could actually work so that you actually have something to offer when the teams come to the door wanting to do it.
That's super interesting. And that was a success, isn't it?
Yeah, it's doing well. We have a follow-up Reviva product. So we're still launching products within that specialized sub-brand, but we're also planning to move some of this sustainable material stuff over into the traditional Black & Decker brand you're used to. That's orange and black, right? And we felt positive that the sustainability message really resonated, but we don't think it's the right play to lead with it. We think it's they would rather just have the regular lineup with the, you know, the sustainability benefits built into there, right, is what we're thinking. So I think that's a pretty powerful. We put something out, we got a response. And to me, mainstreaming it shows progress rather than having the specialized area for just the green customers that want that. There shows enough demand that generally people want it across the whole brand. I thought
that's a maturity curve. There's companies have started doing that. I think there was a brand that killed their sustainability portfolio. Principally, they said, well, all our products now fit that same requirement, and we need to redefine what sustainability would mean if all our baseline products have those same features. I've seen this repeatedly, right? In the automotive space, it's also the same thing. You'll never go and change the entire product line first. You try and launch something which is unique in a small kind of test environment. Probably this is a new product line. Maybe this is a new feature within an existing product line. And then you kind of try to see, does it work? And if it does, then you kind of map that to the broader portfolio and try and bring the whole portfolio to another level as a consequence. I think that's as successful as it gets, Dan.
That's something we're really happy about. More to come on that this year on those launches.
I read something around your split in between how you view sustainability primary. So products where sustainability is the primary versus products where the product is the primary. Could you say, I was very curious about this. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so that graphic you're mentioning is the conversion we're talking about, where Reviva was like, you know, it's 50% recyclable content in the enclosure. It's got a recyclable box. You know, we put up an end of life tool recycling program, because in North America, that's not legislatively required anywhere like it is in Europe, right? So we tried to build product line with circularity thinking tied to it and really launch it on like, it's sustainable and it's a drill. And now that position is, it's a Black & Decker drill. It's got an 18-volt battery pack. It can do all this hard work, and its sustainability is part of the deal here. We're just building it into the brand. So that's really the shift that image is showing.
It's almost like a circle, right? Because you started with product primary without sustainability.
Exactly.
Then you took a fork into sustainability primary. You saw that it worked. And then you circled back where it becomes the product primary again with sustainability added on.
Exactly.
That is so cool.
I don't know that we planned it that way, Neil, but you're exactly right. That's what happened. It's kind of cool. It'll be interesting to see other features and stuff go through that, where it's, you know, like brushless motors, right? It was a big thing to, hey, this is brushless. And now it's kind of become standard on everything because everyone loved it. It's more energy efficient. And now you don't have to say it much anymore because it's assumed everything's brushless.
I think that's the flywheel of innovation, right? This is how you do it, that the whole portfolio moves forward by embedding successful experiments back into it.
Exactly.
And I think how you justify the new experiments, we use sustainability, we use the regulation, we use customers demanding it, we use lawsuits, whatever these drivers are, right? It is always this maturity curve. You start with something small and then it becomes more complicated and then it needs to become simple again. And the simple thing is that it gets embedded into the standard product portfolio once more.
We had a conversation with a product manager a little while ago, and his comment was for his particular category. He said that two things have to happen. One, the senior manager had to be behind it. And the other one that really is sort of keeping the senior managers up at night is what happens at the end of life. And so two things, end of life and what happens on the social responsibility of their suppliers. And so I'm just wondering, had both of those come front and center with the Stanley Black & Decker products? I mean, there's a whole gamut of things that you have, but are those two or three issues that are really critical to your senior managers?
I would say yes, and then they're critical to me and then roll up to senior manager. Okay. With my role focused on product, we divide up ESG here between a people pillar, a product pillar, and a planet pillar. And so I'm in the product pillar, which is the two main goals are scope 3 and circularity. So scope 3 being mainly buying better materials to make our products out of. So that's a lot of the supply chain interface, asking them to set science-based targets, understanding their emission profile so they can share it with us. And also this big push we have for electrification, especially in the outdoor and larger power tool equipment space. We even recently just in the World of Concrete in Vegas unveiled a suite of 6 tools for concrete working that had all traditionally been gas powered. And we're launching a really large battery that can help them do their job all day, right? So now not breathing emissions, maintenance costs are going to go down, all that benefit that come with being able to do that cordless. So, and that helps obviously reduce use phase emissions. And so those two goals are within my scope, as well as circularity, which is like standing up end of life recycling and figuring, again, we're not mature enough there to figure out how do we get what comes back through the recycling program to our supplier so that it costs us to buy it the next time around. That's like the holy grail of making it work, right? And, logistics and all that is costing a little too much these days to really make that work. But it will get there, either through demand or regulatory policies making virgin material very expensive. So, but we will get there.
No, that's great. I mean, I think that just listening to you, I mean, part of what my follow-on question was, sounds like you've got wonderful successes in your, sustainability priority and product priority. What I like about that is that you've taken what could be in some series of ad hoc activities and put them into two pillars. So you know you're on a sustainability primary or a product primary, and then that can be used to communicate and use that as a way to leverage and communicate across the whole organization as well as with customers. So I was curious a little bit, how have you rolled that out across the entire enterprise of the whole range of products that Stanley Black & Decker has?
I don't think we've gone far enough there. I mean, my vision of it is that we create essentially a playbook of standardized, common ESG advances you can make within our products, right? Because, we're constrained by what we can do in ESG by the products we make. So things like a program with like logos that say, this has something better about it. And then, it's electrified or it's got recycled content or whatever, right? It's sort of a menu of standard claims we could get. Product management could see that and say, hey, we have the ability to do this, check, check, check. And then maybe those claims map themselves to engineering requirements and definitions that say to earn this logo, you need to do this and that and the other. And then so they mark it on the product spec. Engineers do it during the development. You're able to claim it at the end, right? So you kind of put it in front, like as a menu. That's my hope. We don't have that yet, but I think that's
Why is that? Is that because you just came up with the idea or is it hard to do?
I don't live in the world of brand and marketing, and I'm sure there's a lot going on there that they need to fix before they get to that, right? So I think it might just be we've got to do a couple of different things here, right? I mean, we're going through some big changes in how we look at brands and different things. So I think just a lot of work has been in front of this. It's not that they don't want to. But to me,
it's just a really cool idea, right?
Yeah.
Because it templatizes, I think, sustainability, unfortunately, until now has been super generic. You have experts in sustainability who are not experts in product. And there's a translation that always misses. And this is an easy, I think it's almost when I think of things, I think of how do you scale stuff?
Right.
And you scale it by removing the abstraction. You need to make it obvious to people who are designing products. This is what it means. And I think that's a really simplistic way of doing it. I would say simple, not simplistic, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a cool idea.
Yeah. So my hope is we'll be able to get back on that again. And then maybe that logo can be used either, I don't know if it'll be brand specific or across brands. I mean, we know really that this is another issue, like other big companies like P&G, or I mean, they're much bigger, but you know, nobody resonates. Stanley Black & Decker doesn't sell a product with that logo on it, right? That's purely a corporate logo. So, and I have to check myself on this too, because I'm in the corporate teams. You know, I'm thinking about stuff that covers everyone, but you got to appreciate at the end of the day, right? The end user is like, well, what's DeWalt doing for me? Well, tell me what Craftsman's doing. Right? Well, it's kind of the same company, but they don't know that. Yeah. I think the messaging has to bleed through the brand. And if that means unique looking logos for each brand, but maybe we standardize the engineering requirements under the topical thing, right? That's fair.
Yeah, gotcha.
Well, something we like to do on this podcast too, as we come to the end, is do a roundtable. And here's something practical that a product manager could implement next week, Monday morning, as Jim likes to say. Dan, what would your suggestion or recommendation be to product managers about something they could start as early as next week on how to do this better?
So one of my favorites is look at all the projects you have on your list and make sure within the scope of whatever you're attempting to do in that project that you're either making progress somewhere socially, like you're benefiting that end user in some way, you're keeping them safer, you're making whatever they do quicker, cleaner, or you're delivering the same function you did before, but with less impact on the earth. And if you're doing one of those two things, then you know, your needle, I think, is pointing in the right direction. For an example of a counter to that, I was at a conference at one point in time and somebody shared a story about doing a new shampoo. And the idea was basically make the pump a little more out. And the theory behind it was, you know, the end user's not going to know a little extra was there. They'll go through the bottle quicker and you'll sell the next bottle. If you step back and look at that, you don't see any benefit to the end user, right? Because they're getting less value for their money as they're wasting. And then it's bad for the earth because they're wasting product. To me, that should tell you in your gut, that's not the right way to be moving forward, even though it makes the business more money, right? So that to me is a quick check of, you know, making sure what's profitable also aligns with what's good for the world and people in general.
I think when people were not connected the way they are today, you could get away with something like that. Mm-hmm. Today, the way we're hyper-connected, I mean, my mother knows about what I'm doing before my wife does, and we live together with my wife, right? And this is just a personal anecdote, but I think these kind of things spread very quickly, and they can kill your brand, they can kill your company. And if you're a startup, these kind of things are just the end. Shelley usually asks us this question too, and I would steal yours, Dan. I think this logos is made me very curious. Just think, what are the sustainability benefits that one could drive in a company? Just sit on a table, write this on a clean sheet of paper, five things that you could address in terms of sustainability, and what would be the technical or functional requirement that would map to that for the product that you're responsible for. I think spending a few hours, and it's not as simple as one may think. Because many of these points are based on, I would say, they're false assumptions, right? Based on, I think green steel is better than aluminum. I read a story about that. Does it really matter for our business? Do we need that? Can we replace that? I think it's an exercise that would force someone to not just think of sustainability, but think about whether it's relevant to their business and whether they could apply it in a real way. And I don't think we do this often enough.
What I was thinking about, Dan, listening to you, was the whole issue of going from a Stanley Black & Decker perspective down to the brand. Mm-hmm. And that you emphasized the brand. And I remember the work that we did with Johnson & Johnson and the Earthward program. There were 8 questions that was talked about right at the beginning of the scoping and discovery stage that they had to answer before they could move to the next stage. And it was nothing elaborate in an LCA. Does your product use water? I mean, does it energy? I mean, things that trigger out of 8, there are these 3 that are going to be important. And then I can begin to focus. Instead, the problem is sustainability is such a broad term. It means anything and everything, and people get confused. And so you go it by the brand by brand and say, okay, these are the 2, 3, 4, 5 things that are critical from a sustainability perspective for that brand, and then work within that. I sort of support this sort of direction. It's not defined sustainability. It's relevant to each brand, not as an overall Stanley Black & Decker perspective.
Unfortunately, there are so few people who know how to do this. But that's an awesome idea.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and this has been wonderful. And it's always fun having a conversation. And we've been doing this for a long, long time. I'm glad that we're able to do it and actually record it. Oftentimes we've had the conversation that's not recorded and we come back. Now, what did we talk about again? So this is great. Well, now it'll be recorded and broadcast to the world.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really great. And as you said, Jim, in the beginning, I mean, I knew you before I actually had a real full-time job at Stanley. I was still an intern, right, when Ted introduced me to you. So I've known you my whole career, literally, even before it.
That's right. And I remember many conversations, and I said, have you finished your PhD yet? You had everything but your dissertation done. And I said, get that dissertation done. You don't want to be working at Stanley or Black & Decker then, all but, you know, dissertation, you know, on your PhD. So I'm glad you did, and
Thank you.
I've been enjoying watching your career. It's been quite wonderful.
Yeah, it was great learnings, I think, for our listeners today. And a reminder to our listeners, you can always reach us at contact@fivelivestofifty.com to let us know what you think of this episode. And this season, we'll be interviewing many more leaders in the area of product sustainability. So stay tuned for our next episode next month. Thanks for listening.